even 10 minutes a day talking to a friend or acquaintance will do wonders for your mental and in turn physical health. So when I heard that, I was like, well, you know what? I'm going to start with that because I have days where I don't have a conversation like this with anybody. I'm not lucky enough to spend an hour with Joanne and Karen. And I'm here by myself. I'm doing good work, but I work by myself in my home. And so when I heard that, I thought, you know what? I'm going to make that effort to have at least a 10-minute conversation with someone I care about. And so I'm working on that.
This is the Dishing Doulas podcast with Joanne Hahn and Karen Hendrickson of Death Doula Network International, changing the world's approach to dying and death one conversation at a time. Seriously, let's talk. Whether you're an end-of-life professional, a family caregiver, or you simply want to gain comfort with end-of-life matters, we're here to help expand your comfort with our shared mortality, end-of-life planning, and the important conversations. The views shared in this podcast are solely those of the hosts and our guests and are provided for information purposes only. Be sure to consult with your own healthcare and legal professionals for any personal medical or legal advice.
Jennifer O'Brien has helped thousands live and love more fully by recognizing that at the end of life comes death. Family caregiving is both the hardest job and the greatest honor most of us will ever face. And grief is abundant love with no place to go. She's the author of The Hospice Doctor's Widow, a journal, an art journal filled with beauty, practical insights, humor, and heart. The book has won Nautilus Silver Award in Death and Dying, Grief and Loss category, a Next Gen Indie Book Gold for Relationships, an Independent Publishers Bronze for Gift, and International Impact Award for its interior design. For 35 plus years, she's been a practice management consultant to physicians. She's served as CEO for two large physician practices, authored 55 plus pieces of published in professional and peer-reviewed journals, and spoken to audiences ranging in size from 5 to 1500. She holds a bachelor's degree from Boston University and a master's degree in organization development from Loyola University, Chicago. She lives in Little Rock, Arkansas, and we are thrilled to have Jennifer O'Brien with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This is an honor and a pleasure.
Well, thanks for saying yes.
Yep, always yes to you too.
That's fabulous. Today, we're going to ask you to dive into the conversation around the solar ager. But before we get into all of that, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up becoming such a thought leader when it comes to end-of-life planning with this deep desire to help others to be as prepared as possible?
Okay, I'm just really loving that you're calling me a thought leader. I'm not sure I'm a thought leader, but I can tell you that to some degree, it all started a little over 40 years ago, when my only sibling, David, was in an accident. I was 18. He was 13. He was in a motor vehicle accident. And about 3 weeks post MVA, he had to be extubated and died due to a number of inactivity in the brain and that sort of thing. And that really shaped me. As you can imagine, it shaped the person, the adult I became, and just about everything, whether I knew it or not at the time. And I think I know more now about how it shaped me. Not quite 20 years after his death, my mom got pancreatic cancer and lived for 5 weeks following the diagnosis. And I was her caregiver. I think she died about 6 months before the 20th anniversary of David's accident. I think that was a blessing for her. I don't think she wanted to live through that 20th anniversary. And I've been in healthcare on the administrative side of things for 35 years. And so I came down in 2009 from Chicago to Little Rock, Arkansas to do an interim CEO position for a very large orthopedic surgery practice. Those interim leadership positions usually last 2 to 4 years, and I hire my replacement and I get out. But this time, while I was down here in Little Rock from Chicago, I met and fell in love with Bob Lemberg, who had been a physician for many, many years by that time. Had first been a plastic and reconstructive surgeon, but because of a neck injury, he couldn't operate without excruciating pain. So before I even met him, he had retrained and gotten himself board certified in hospice and palliative medicine. And this was, besides the fact that he was super cute and smart and just all around adorable, this was really compelling to me because I knew from my personal experience how important his professional work was. And so we fell crazy in love and we got married and I finished up the orthopedic job finally. And we were living the dream. He was on faculty at our med center here in Little Rock and academic med center. And then he found a couple of lumps on the left side of his neck. And after some diagnostics, it turned out to be a renal clear cell carcinoma. And it was already stage 4 and metastatic to many, many places in his body. And he lived for 22 months following that diagnosis. I was taking care of him. Bob did not have kids, and I have never had any kids. So I was his only caregiver. And while I was caring for him, I kept an art journal. I kept all my thoughts and feelings in an art journal. Kept going with that for a little bit after he died, and then doing another one of those interim CEO positions. I shared it with a physician I worked with, and he said, "Jennifer, you have to figure out how to get this published because it could really help a lot of people." And that was really a compelling thing, because just that when you are able to bring some sort of help to others and meaning to what you've gone through, that's just really powerful. So I did. I found a publisher, and my art journal came out as a book called The Hospice Doctor's Widow, A Journal, in February of 2020. I just hit the 4-year mark. The photos from the book launch party came up on my Facebook. So that's how it happened. So I've been sort of known as the Hospice Doctor's Widow for about 4 years. And the book has done really well. It won some awards, but I think perhaps more important to me is that it's helped a lot of people and stimulated a lot of conversations. And that is what I think is most important at this point, because what Bob and I did is we thoroughly prepared for his death and my survivorship. And it didn't make it easy to lose him. It made it easier on me after he died. And those demonstrations of his love just continue to come through even many years after his death, because we were so open with each other about it and prepared so thoroughly. And so I want everybody else to experience that. So I'm going to tell the story and I'm going to keep telling the story. So yeah, I don't know about thought leader, but I am experienced in losing people I love.
But you are a thought leader, because what you're sharing and what you've put out into the world and what you continue to share as a result of your passion and your commitment to this work of supporting others is changing how other people approach this space, whether they're a caregiver or they're looking at their own end of life planning. I know for myself, since early 2020, when I first received a copy of your book, it has been like a Bible for me as a caregiver.
Yeah. Good. Thank you.
Like it really has been just like
that is the reason. I mean, I'm not going to lie. It is not easy to allow your very private art journal about the saddest time in your life to be published as a book. And it comes with all kinds of things that I couldn't have possibly anticipated. Not the least of which is that when someone asks to read the book and someone special, you know, so-called special influencer type person, and you send them a copy of the book and then they seemingly never read it. It is painful. Stories like yours, Karen, that makes it all worthwhile, even the tough stuff. That is the reason for doing it. And so thank you for that feedback. I really appreciate it.
I mean, your book in and of itself was the first place when I opened the pages, and I still do it. I have it with me here. I'm not at home right now because Paul's in hospital, but I have it with me and I open it up every day. And there's a page that just lets me know that I am not alone in this journey as a caregiver, that everything I feel and experience is being felt and experienced by others, and at the same time, we'll be okay. Yeah. So thank you for your work. Yeah.
So Jennifer, since Bob's death, the last of your immediate family, your father, has also died.
Yeah.
And now you're not only a widow, but you're also a solo ager.
Yes.
What does that mean for you?
Well, there's actually a definition of a solo ager. A solo ager is someone over the age of 55 who lives alone, either by choice or by circumstance, who either never had kids or has outlived their children or child, or is estranged from them. No obvious heirs, I think, is a way to sort of summarize that, you know, post age 55. That's the broadly accepted definition of a solo ager. I am 58. I have called myself a childless orphaned widow on occasion. All of those things are true. That's me. Ironically, as lonely as it sounds to be a solo ager, or as alone as it sounds, I am not at all alone. In Canada, by the way, they call them kinless agers more commonly, or the dreaded elderly orphans. Like, okay, could you pick two like uglier terms and put them together for us? But anyway, in Canada, the over 55 population, 11% are solo agers. And in the US, 7.2%, according to the Oxford Journal of Geriatrics, did a study in 2018, or reported on a study in 2018. So it's a fair number of people over the age of 55 that are living alone and have no obvious heirs. And I certainly am one of them. Yeah.
I wonder why the difference in terms between Canada and the United States.
I don't know.
It's interesting.
I mean, it's not hard and fast, but it is a term. When I read a couple of Canadian articles, it referred to them as kinless. And so
is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the definition is the same, you know. Yeah.
And so you are known often for referencing the triad of certainty.
Yeah.
At the end of life comes death. There are no do-overs in end of life. And changed forever, loved ones remain and remember.
Yes.
And so as a solo ager, does this still bode true?
Oh, I don't know why it wouldn't. We can take it step by step. At the end of life, still comes death for a solo ager. We don't get a second shot at it, like no dress rehearsal. And our loved ones remain and remember. I mean, just because we don't have blood relatives doesn't mean that we don't leave people behind who will remember us and who have loved us. So yeah, I think it remains and nothing really changes about that.
Yeah, I thought that was an important question, because that term of solo ager and this idea of being single, right, in the space without family or support may lead people to sometimes believe that that means that they really are alone and people won't remember them. And we all know that family has all kinds of definitions, and friendships and loyalties and love and care remain regardless. So
right.
Thank you for that. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you for that.
So Jen, as a solo ager, what new challenges have become apparent for you in your advanced care and end of life and estate planning?
Well, I will start by saying one of the most difficult things that a lot of solo agers go through, and not just solo agers, other folks that have gone through some type of loss of someone in their life. One of the hardest things that happens is completing the in case of emergency line at the doctor or any other thing that you do in your life. About 1,000 years ago, long before I met Bob, I was married to another man. John was his name, or is his name. He's not dead. I'm just not married to him. And we got divorced. And I remember having a lot of trouble when I had to fill the in case of emergency form out. I remember having this trouble really all throughout my adulthood. I remember sitting down with John and our lawyer and doing our wills, and the lawyer would turn to John and say, okay, if you and Jennifer die at the same time, who do you want all of your court part to go to? And he would say, my sister. And I burst into tears, of course, because I no longer had a sibling to leave everything to. So on some level, I've been dealing with this for 40 years. But those are hard things. And I think it's important for the world to know that, and especially for doulas to know that, for people in this space to know. I wish more doctor's offices understood what a trigger that is for people, for widows especially. But anyway, so there's a lot of emotion. There's an added layer of emotion to all that end of life preparation when you're doing it alone, when you have no obvious heirs, when you have no living blood relatives left. I think there's an added layer of emotion for sure, because it's hard to fill that form out. For me, I think a lot about the fact that I'm the last one standing, right? Like, there are no kids, there's no grandbabies. So I'm the end of the line. And when I die, that'll be it for this particular genealogical line. And that's an interesting, fascinating thing. I think another tricky thing is, at least for me, has been that right now, most of my proxy, my agent, my executor are all my age. And so I am keenly aware that in all likelihood, that will change. I have my eye out on some youngsters that are going to move into that position. Some of them know it, some of them don't. But, you know, some folks, you really want someone younger. I totally trust the people I've selected, but there's a good chance that they're going to go first, or one or more of them is going to have end up with dementia or Alzheimer's or that sort of thing. So I've sort of got my eye out for that. I've made some other provisions too, some really practical things. I don't know if you want to get into that level of detail, but you know, when Bob and I moved, we had a big house and we sold it and moved into a condominium as part of our preparation for my survivorship, mainly because I'm not a big house garden kind of a person. But a cool byproduct of that was that we moved into a single layer I'm on a single layer and I don't have stairs. And I think that's really important. Last night I was scrolling through videos, of course, on social media, and there was this lovely little lesson from an older woman in her house. She went downstairs, she made herself tea, and she's talking about kindness and how important it is to learn how to be kind to yourself. And I'm hook, line, and sinker, right? I'm with this gal, and she's as cute as she can be. She has this frilly long nightgown on, and she lives in this quaint little house and getting her tea and gets back. And the whole time I'm like, oh my God, those stairs are so steep for you. You know, like, she is going to break a hip one of these days on those damn stairs. They're uncarpeted. They're very steep. I'm watching the stuff in her house, and I'm thinking, oh, okay, it's time to outfit the place. It might be time to put the place on the market and buy something on a single level, as cute as it was. And I'm sure that's not easy, but that was a complete sidetrack for me that, you know, she looked a good 10, 15, perhaps even 20 years older than I am, and clearly was living in a place that was not going to serve her well as her ability to ambulate, you know, diminishes. So I've already done that. I'm already in a single layer level dwelling. I am about to redo my bathroom because it has a very slippery floor. So I'm going to go ahead and redo it and go ahead and put some grab bars in it and get taller toilet and all that sort of stuff, because why wouldn't I? I mean, I'm 58, you know, I don't want to redo it again in 5 years or whatever. And so it's just smart to me to do it and to look ahead and to see these things coming, to just stay in front of them, to be fixing these things along the way. So yeah, that's as far as the estate. I have also purchased a whole life insurance policy, which is the type of policy that will pay out if I need someone to assist me. If I become disabled in a way and I need help, it will start paying for that. And if I never need that and I die not needing it, it will pay upon my death to my trust. And I also have a provision in my will for the executor will get paid. And I, honestly, I don't think that should be limited to solo agers. Quite frankly, like the latest study says that people who are spending 500 hours settling the average estate as an executor. So, you know, I don't think it should be strictly solo agers who realize that's a lot of time, if you're able to build compensation in for that, you should, because it's a lot of work. It's not even just the time, it's a lot of work. And so anyway, I've done that. Those are the main things. Trying to think what else.
Do you think solo agers in some respects actually could be better at planning and preparation because they don't have immediate family? Do you think that might call them to be more prepared than, you know, we know up here in Canada, like still today, after all these years, only 50% of us actually even have a will.
It's a lot lower down here. Well, tell you what, I think solo aging, and one of the reasons I'm actually enjoying this conversation, is one we have to do as solo agers, like I said earlier, is we have to see ahead. We have to see ahead to what's coming, you know, and what the statistics say, right? 4 out of 5 of us are not going to die in a fiery auto accident. We are going instantaneously. We are going to get sick. We are going to get old, and we are going to die then, right? So we know that 80% of us, right? So that's probably going to be me. That's probably going to be you too. And so just leaving it up to chance and hoping I drop dead someday is not wise. And more importantly, if I don't stay ahead, I will ultimately lose autonomy, right? Because that lovely little lady fixing her tea and teaching me the lesson of kindness last night on Instagram, she is going to fall and break her hip or hurt herself and be unable to get up and down those stairs. And all of a sudden, that house is going to become a burden, either financial burden because she can't get out of it fast enough, or, you know, some other sort of burden on her or somebody else because she's going to have to go to a facility, that sort of thing. So we can maintain our own agency and our own autonomy longer if we stay ahead of what's happening. And I think, yeah, who knows, that could be the way that solo agers are able to make it. Another nice thing I will tell you about being a solo ager is you get to choose stuff, you know, you don't have to argue about the curtains. You get to pick the curtains out yourself. You know what I mean?
You don't have to negotiate. No negotiation.
Right. And occasionally that is sad. But lots of times that is just fine to not have to negotiate every single thing. So again, I say this and it's true. Of course, I still would just like rather be arguing with Bob about what we're having for dinner, but actually we wouldn't argue about it. He was the cook. So, but there is that advantage. And so what I'm suggesting is expand that. And take responsibility for what's ahead. You know, you guys are Canadian. So Wayne Gretzky, the hockey dude, you know, you skate to where the puck is going, right? That's where you skate. You skate to where the puck is going. So that's what we need to do as we manage our futures so that we can, when the time comes, do the research on the facilities in your area that you would be willing to move into if you could no longer live alone in your own house. Do the research as to what you have to do to your own house in order to stay there the longest possible time. Do the research on which hospice you would like to be the patient of, which doula you would like. I mean, it's going to happen. And doing this research and planning is only going to allow you to get what you want as it happens, instead of waiting until an injury or an illness or something, and you haven't done anything, and now you're dependent on others, and you haven't done any research, and you certainly can't do it when you're sick, or it's a lot harder. Let's put it that way, especially as, again, as a solo ager, right? When Bob was sick, he had me, and I was well, and between the two of us, we were able to get a lot of stuff done. But when you're solo, you know, you got to do it ahead of time.
And most of us don't like to admit that we're going to need it at some point.
Oh, that's true. That's certainly true. We don't like to admit it. But I'll tell you, worse than that is knowing that you were going to need it and you didn't do the damn homework. I mean, that to me, that's no bueno.
I've wondered with that solo ager if sometimes the thought that they may carry is that, well, it's only me, so who cares now? It doesn't matter.
Sure.
Whatever happens, happens.
I mean, I certainly have moments like that, right? It is hard to be alone. And the self-pity party, man, there's only one invited to that party and they always show up. You know what I mean? And they show up in spades. And so that is absolutely a factor. Is that whole, well, nobody cares. Who cares anyway? And that gets to another thing that I'm doing to prepare, for my death to some degree, but perhaps more for my life between now and the time I die. And that is my circle. You know, there's some really great work being done on the topic of loneliness, and solo agers have not cornered the market on loneliness. I mean, there are plenty of people at all ages, in all familial settings, who are fighting profound loneliness, at least in the U.S. I don't think it's much different in Canada. We are lucky enough right now in the U.S. to have a Surgeon General whose name is Vivek Murthy, and he has written an amazing book about loneliness and combating loneliness, and he, in so much of the work he is doing, is all about combating loneliness. And and I would say that your circle or your, you know, and it doesn't, we don't necessarily have to have a big circle. We can have a small circle, but your people require of you some effort for both initiating, if you don't already have an existing circle or group of people, initiating and then maintaining. And both of those things are a lot of work, but I would contend they're no more work than it is to be a member of a family. A lot of work to be a member of a family. It's a lot of work to be in a marriage, you know, and it's a lot of work to be a solo ager who is putting in the effort to build and maintain their people. And I say circle, the people don't all have to know each other. You know, it doesn't have to be a club. You can be at the center of that. And I do recommend some degree of cross pollination there, just because that way, if and when something happens, you know, people can get in touch with each other. If you have a problem, people can get in touch with your other friends, sort of thing. But yes, and that's a hard one to me, honestly. That's a lot. That one is a hard one. It's easier for me to do my end of life documents than it is to call a friend and say, I need help. I mean, that's the hardest thing for me to do, is to ask someone for help. I mean, off the charts, so difficult. even when I'm paying for it. Like, even when I'm paying the handyman, it's just like, why can't I do this myself, you know? But what we're doing there is channeling that desire for independence and saying, I am going to create a world that allows me as much independence as is possible for as long as possible. And even after that independence may no longer be possible, I have put the effort in to building this future for myself, either being in this facility, being in touch with these people, you know, that sort of thing. That's mine.
I wonder sometimes if, you know, depending how someone has become a solo ager. So let's say they were married and now they're a widow. I wonder if in some cases they also, just as a result of having lived that experience and lost a partner, if they, that alone actually in some cases can call us to have to actually rebuild circle, create new circles, right?
Well, like, I think for sure either that alone causes you to rebuild circle. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons there are widowed groups, whether it's widowed people or widowed women. There are some really strong communities of people who have lost their partner. And it's because when you haven't been through it, you don't understand. And you can be empathetic, but lots of people are not able to be empathetic or just give up on the whole thing. And I get it, because I lost my brother and my mother at such a young age. As the years have continued since then, I've had friends who then lost a sibling or a parent or whatever, and said to me in that immediate after loss, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry I wasn't more there for you, now that I know what it's like. And you can accept that apology and just say, of course, you can't know until you've been through it. You just can't. You can do your best to offer empathy, but you really don't know. So yes, I think after your person dies, there are people who lose patience with you. You know, they see you as sad all the time. They don't want to be around sadness. And so they sort of disappear. There are people who think it only lasts a year and that they can really be there for you, and they are there for you for 6 months or a year. And when you're still not over it, those were air quotes for those of you listening. There were some air quotes there. When you're not over it, they kind of lose patience with that. And again, disappear, and you feel it. So anyway, I think you definitely end up building a new circle. And then there are some people that show up like big time that you did not even see that coming, right? Like that some people came through that you were barely acquainted with, but they've probably been through something similar. And so they know what it's like to lose your people because your spouse died. So yes, your circle definitely shifts. And the other thing that taps into is, when I say how much work it is to build and maintain your circle, you don't have that energy during the initial grieving period, right? And so that's why those support groups are so important, because it needs to happen with less effort. But when you're feeling like you can carry your loss and your grief, and you're feeling better, like I am at this point, 7 years after Bob died. Yeah, I have that. I can now put that energy in. I can now be there for others who are in a more acute grief, or I can build my circle and maintain my circle and put some effort into it.
Circles are so very important though, right? Because I live alone as well. And I say to people, if you don't hear from me for 3 days in a row, check. Just shoot me a note and just make sure that everything's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I live in this condo building, and the guy who works at the front desk in the daytime during the weekdays, his name is Chuck. And I tell him, you are the most important man in my life at this point, right? And he and I have talked about, my second most important man in my life is my stylist. just so we're clear. Do have my priorities straight. Anyway, no, He's there and he pays attention to everybody coming and going. And he knows that I'm alone. And we moved in here about 10 months before Bob died, and he knew Bob. And it's important to have any, you know, we initially had that conversation. He went ahead and gave me his cell phone number, his own cell phone number, not just the one that you use to communicate with whoever's working down at that front desk, but his cell phone number. It's nothing weird. It's just someone who knows where I live, and he knows where the hidden key is to my unit, even though he, you know, like he knows he has permission to come in here if he's worried, kind of thing. I mean, he never does, but you know, if something happens, if it starts to smell, if there starts to be a foul odor coming from this condo, I want him to go ahead and come in and call the authorities.
That's why I say the 3-day check-in.
Yeah.
But you have to, right? When we live alone, when we're on our own and people don't hear from us, it's important that somebody just checks. They say, and like you talked about earlier with isolation, isolation's the new smoking, especially for the elderly.
Yes, yes. Yes, important. Absolutely. It is totally the new smoking. And that's such a great analogy, because honestly, there's a little addiction element to it, right? Like sometimes I can get myself wrapped up in being alone. Sometimes that, like, there's a difference between alone and lonely. And I'm an ambivert, and I have done a lot of therapy and a lot of, you know, self-development, and I am perfectly capable of being alone for significant periods of time. But I can also, those little, you know, inner critics and doubt demons and those voices can really convince me that, oh, no, they're really busy. They're off with their big family. They're everyone. It's one of the reasons, actually, that I last year went to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I spent 2 months there, and I'll do it again this summer. And it's because I tell people, there aren't many advantages to being a childless orphaned widow, but one of them is you can spend the summer where you want to spend the summer. And one of the reasons it's the summer is because where I live, the weather here is miserable during the summer in Little Rock, Arkansas. I mean, it's exceedingly hot and humid. And in the months of at least July and August, sometimes well into September, going out after 8 a.m. is just dangerous. Like, it is so hot and humid. So what happens in the summer here is that everybody goes to their lake houses every weekend. Everyone go on vacation to the beach, or they do all this stuff. And I end up alone and then feeling even lonelier, because I pull up social media and everyone else is off with their people. And I'm here alone, and I can't even go outside after 8 a.m. So I choose to spend the summers now in a place that has a lot of other solo agers, and it has a more tolerable temperature and interesting in lots of other ways. And that's where I grew up, so I have a lot of friends there. But back to that thing of that loneliness and aloneness can be addictive and can be like the yarn ball, you know, that just sort of, or snowball rather, that grows and grows. And then you find yourself kind of going, oh no, that, you know, they don't even want to see me if I go to that thing. Where did that come from? You know what I mean?
Yeah, the poor me. Oh, yeah, poor me. Poor I me. Have nobody, right?
Yeah.
I have
nobody. Nobody really likes me. And so I might as well just stay home and be even more alone and lonely. So that's what I that's what I mean kind of when I say the hard work of creating it and then maintaining it. And knowing, and it's tricky too, because it's not really any port in a storm. You know what I mean? It's not just anybody. I want to say yes to most invitations because I want people to ask again. But I don't necessarily need to say yes to every invitation. If it's really not, you know what I mean? Doesn't mean you don't have boundaries, because that could be, that can be another problem, but you got to work at it. And I say all of this with current experience. I mean, I am working on this now very hard as I try my, how do I re-enter the world post-pandemic and be with whom I want to be with and still have my self time? And how do I balance all that? Though that challenge, I think, exists for everyone, not just solo agers and not just family people. There, you know, we went through a big thing for several years of being alone or being in our bubbles, whether our bubbles were with other people or our bubbles were a bubble of one. And how do you re-enter the world with a new reality? And some of us lost friends to death during that period, or family, friends and family to death during that period. Some of us ended marriages during that period. Some ended friendships, fell apart, or isn't going to come back to what it was. And so, you know, it's building the future, kind of going forward.
Do you find it to be a little bit exhausting sometimes, though, keeping up that circle, going out maybe a little bit more than you normally would?
I suppose it could get exhausting. I mean, that's why I say you still have to have boundaries and you don't say yes to everything and everyone. Again, I will bring up this idea of making your own future, right? So if my goal is to make sure I'm connected in my circle, then maybe I'm going to start with expressing gratitude to a few people. Maybe I'm going to this week write 4 notes to friends, and next week it's going to be 4 different friends, and I'm going to put myself out there in that way. Vivek Murthy, who is our Surgeon General, said even 10 minutes a day talking to a friend or acquaintance will do wonders for your mental and in turn physical health. So when I heard that, I was like, well, you know what? I'm going to start with that. Because I have days where I don't have a conversation like this with anybody. I'm not lucky enough to spend an hour with Joanne and Karen. And I'm here by myself. I'm doing good work, but I work by myself in my home. And so when I heard that, I thought, you know what? I'm going to make that effort to have at least a 10-minute conversation with someone I care about. And so I'm working on that.
And so that is so indicative of so many things that we look at in relation to all of our living, I think, in a lot of ways. But even just around this sort of this planning and preparing, always everything all seems so big. If you're starting at square one, it all seems so big, so overwhelming, and so exhaustive. So to know that just you could focus on 10 minutes and then everything else over the course of time will become a little bit easier because you're maintaining that human connection. So I think for some of us that are disconnected or become disconnected for whatever reasons that might be, COVID or illness or whatever it is, we've created this, we're in this space where we need to rebuild circle. It can feel so overwhelming that we just paralyze. So I love that. I just absolutely love that. 10 minutes.
Yeah, I've never heard that before. That's interesting. I'm going to start trying that because I'm the same as you. I live alone and I work from home.
Yeah. He also talks about, he's done a tour in the US of a lot of colleges because there's a lot of young folks that are really suffering from this. And he has them from the podium. He asks them to think about, is there someone in your life that you feel gratitude for or toward? And of course, everybody nods and he says, okay, well, take out your phone and write them a text or an email expressing that gratitude right now. And when you're finished, turn on the flashlight of your phone and hold it up.
Wow.
Right? And he said, he talked about that in another one of his, I don't know, a podcast interview that I was listening to. And he's just like, it's powerful to see everybody in the room start to hold up their phone flashlight, that they have made a connection. And honestly, and he's right. I think that the perfect way to start is, who do you feel gratitude toward, and go ahead and express that gratitude. I mean, do unto others. It's what you would want to hear. It's a message you would want to receive. So why not put it out to someone else? And I do firmly believe that what we put out into the world comes back to us. So why not put out the gratitude and the desire and the expression to be in community with someone or someone's, and it'll come back around.
And can you imagine the impact, how powerful that would be if you're sitting in a little bit of a pity party, oh, poor me, nobody loves me, and you get this text message from somebody saying, I really appreciate who you are. Like, how wonderful is that? I love right. that.
And I do love the idea, like, in fact, this conversation is making me realize I saw some friends on Saturday night that I hadn't seen for a long time, and I need to text them, and I need to say that it was a great event, you know, and thank you. Because that's the other thing, is when you do stuff like that, when you put on something, you put a party together, or a book signing, or whatever. I went to a book signing on Saturday night, that's effort. And isn't it nice to hear back that someone enjoyed themselves and someone is taking the time to say, that was really great. Thank you so much for doing it. So yeah. I'll be sending that text after we sign off.
But even if you miss something, you know, I've received texts from people, sorry you couldn't make it the other night, we really missed you.
Yes.
You know, it's just nice to know your presence makes a difference.
Yes. When
you're
yes.
not there, right? You're missed. Yes. It's very important.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. When I was a kid, my parents were a riot, Vicky and Jim. Somebody with this common line, and maybe y'all's parents or people said this too, but they would say, oh, it's been so nice having you. And my mom or dad would say, oh, it's been so nice being had. And I mean, it's a joke, of course, but it's also, it goes both ways, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. It does. I love that.
Yeah.
I think through our conversation today, I think what you've shared with us is that solo agers need, if you will, to be much more diligent, or more diligent than those that have family or heirs in relation to their end of life planning. They need to be more diligent in ensuring that they have their own personal agency as long as possible. And it might take a little more work, but I wonder if it's actually the same work. And it doesn't really matter whether you start this process without being a solo ager. Certainly, if you've done the work beforehand, it makes it way easier if you become the solo ager.
Right.
So not so sure that we need to do it any sooner than later. I think just generally we all need to do it.
Yes.
And if you're a solo ager, you've got an even bigger calling to do it. And even if you aren't, you may become one. So, you know, get your stuff together now.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, for sure.
So for you at this stage, then, if there was two or three really important points around this, whether it was with respect to solo agers or just the whole end of life planning, this getting to this place of recognizing you're going to die. We're all going to die.
Right.
And like, get your shite together.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say if there were a couple of takeaways from this conversation and that I would like to offer to other solo agers, I mean, first of all, of course, you're not alone. You feel alone sometimes, but you're not alone. Those statistics we talked about in the beginning make it very clear that there's a lot of us. There's a lot of us. And maybe finding each other is one thing, but the two big takeaways that I think we've covered is, it's your future. Start making it, right? Yeah. Start making it so that it can be what you want, and start mapping it now. And The second thing I would say is similarly, build your circle and maintain it. There's, you know, another positive side of solo aging is there's not a lot of obligatory relationships. You do not have to go spend Thanksgiving at your sister-in-law's house anymore. I don't think my sister-in-law will listen to this, but you don't have those same obligatory relationships. And that really frees you up to create your own relationships, your own circle, and like I said, your future.
Yeah. So really allowing that opportunity to be discerning or really cognizant and aware of what relationships feel good and those that just cost you more energetically and otherwise than, you know, sort of give to you. Yeah.
Right. Wow. The relationships that are just taking too much out of you, those might have to go on hospice.
Those
might have to die a peaceful death and just kind of fade away. Yes. Yes.
Never thought of putting relationships on hospice before. I love that.
That could be a new line.
I know, I'm putting you on hospice.
I do think there's a great opportunity for doulas in the solo aging world. I will tell you, I have a couple of people that are professionals. They have a therapist. I have my stylist. We talked about that. But I mean, I have a few people in my life that are paid professionals, but they're also, you know, important to me and I'm important to them. And we have relationship. It may be a professional or may start out as a professional relationship. And I think that's a great place for doulas to come in and especially when they're being interviewed or talking with a potential client that is a solo ager and to be able to share with the solo agers what the doulas may have learned during this conversation about how important, perhaps more important in some ways, that these preparations become and the companionship of doula that becomes even more important. I'm one of those people who has every intention of dying alone. Like not the moment the instant I take my last breath, I plan on being alone. And the only person I can really imagine would be a doula with me. Yeah. So I think doulas in particular will benefit from knowing about solo aging and understanding it for sure.
Yeah, I think there's, part of our work always is helping doulas to gain insight into different aspects and perspectives. Oftentimes, certainly new doulas, when they step into this work, originally focus on they're supporting, you know, the old elderly couples and what have you. And the reality is that really can end up just being a small percentage of the work and the opportunity that you can create for other people and support. And so we're grateful for you sharing this information today because it is important. I think it's important for all of us as a society to be aware and cognizant of. I think if we are a solo ager, maybe this will be the call today for us to start to take action if we haven't yet already and sort of planning our future. And we just really appreciate all that you bring to these conversations and in your willingness to help us to change the world's approach to all of this, one conversation at a time. So thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
It's always so much fun hanging out with you, Jennifer O'Brien.
See, I'm not so bad.
You have so much to say. You really do have so much to say. Yeah.
How's Fido doing?
Well, you know, that's another thing is who is going to take Fido when I die?
You have to consider that.
It's a little bit of a dilemma right now. Yes. Yeah, Fido is fine. Fido is, he has been traveling with me lately. We've gone to a couple places. We're headed out to Vegas on Friday to see an old friend. And he's hanging in there. No new tricks for that old dog.
Good. I actually was just talking with a doula last week who had been supporting an elderly man who had a cat. And it was actually his taxidermied cat.
So more similar to Fido than I was initially thinking. By the way, for your listeners, Fido is a plush toy dog, okay? He's not a real dog. He's real. He's just not a living, breathing, eating, pooping dog.
Low maintenance.
You know, when my dad died last year, he had a parrot, and those parrots live a long time. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the things I had to do, was find a place for the parrot. And it was actually before he died, because he broke his hip, and I knew he wouldn't be able to return to where he had been living alone. And so I had to find a spot for the living, breathing parrot.
Yeah.
Robert, the parrot named Robert.
That reminds me of my Auntie Pat. My Auntie Pat had cats her whole life. I don't know how many cats she had, but every one of them had a guy's name. Yeah, Dick, Bob.
Well, now that's a new spin on the old cat lady thing.
Right? It sounds like you have a real person. I have to go home because Bob needs me.
Right. Exactly, right.
That's hilarious.
Awesome. So good. So good to see you.
Wonderful to see you both.
Always a pleasure. And you know, if you're ever feeling lonely, reach out. We're always here.
I will do that.
Be sure to catch the next episode of the Dishing Doulas podcast and more at www.ddnint.com. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast platform. You can send any questions or comments to admin@ddnint.com and connect with us at Death Doula Network International on both Facebook and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you for listening to the Dishing Doulas podcast, where we're changing the world's approach to dying and death, one conversation at a time.